It's
anyway,
simply...
here we go. It is time to bring in territory. It's time for the Media Beat, ladies and gentlemen. Of course, you can find David at his own website, themediabeat.us, also on Huffington Post. He is also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. Ladies and gentlemen, here he is, David Terechuk. Good morning.
Well, hello. It's good to be with you again.
It's always good to have you. It's a miracle. It just works.
Well, a miracle of communication, yes. I'm not in the usual place.
No, you're
not. I'm not in the media capital of the world. I'm much further south.
No, you're in the...
You're a guest at his Oranges Resort?
Yes, he's at the Winter White House. He's at the Winter White House, David. In the last year,
well, I'm about half a mile from what the president wanted to call the Winter White House. Sure, half a mile from Mar-a-Lago. More to the point, 45 minutes from Parkland, the scene of the shooting last week, the school shooting, and as when President Trump and his wife Melania on a rare event these days of them doing something together officially. Went on a hospital visit in Parkland, along, of course, with a visit to first responders. He did refer to the school being just up the road from his club. So there he was doing, what presidents do, what they're meant to do, at least, be consoler-in-chief at a time of great crisis. But we've seen over the course of the week going how much consoling comes naturally. I guess you both saw the extraordinary photograph from the White House photographic press crew during that listening occasion, what was called the listening occasion, when people from Parkland got to go to the White House, follow Trump back to Washington, in fact, and spend time in the White House telling him their own feelings about the appalling murders. And there was one of Trump's important tools of his now trade, cue cards, to help him do the business of being president.
Cue cards that were meant
to help him do that empathy thing, which is supposed to be part of the
cuffs.
President's job.
Did you
see what was written on the card?
Yeah, it was pretty amazing.
And I was trying to figure out whose writing it was.
It's not his.
It wasn't his.
No,
it was nice. They were giving bold capitals. So
they were giving
him.
Listen,
can hear you. With
right.
One particular phrase, wasn't it? That was point number five. He could say, "I can hear you."
Right.
Yeah, I'm glad the president had the had that written down for him to remind him.
Did you see his cuffs, though?
I see a lot of his cuffs. Actually, it's interesting, isn't it?
I'd never known that. Photos being wonderful. You know, you can see a lot of things in photographs. So that was
The cuffs weren't the things that
the
cuffs weren't the things that I was interested in.
But it was just a detail that.
It's not that every president doesn't get briefings from his press people and from people in the White House. It's just that in today's society, we always say, and Joe and I talk about this all the time, when you're out anywhere out, even inside your house, with the availability of the cameras and the recording devices that are on and for simple. Today, never mind professional photographers, you just have to know that anything that you show. Who was the person that was fired from the job for carrying a White House briefing above their, holding it going to an airplane, and a photographer actually zoomed in on it? This happened about five, maybe six, seven years ago. I forget who it was, and you could actually see it was.
Oh, so easily done. Yes,
yeah.
You don't think people are going to zoom in on this small writing or whatever size of writing on a document you're carrying? But of course, if you work in the White House, that's something you have to be wary of. And this is such a media-conscious president. We're constantly told, of course.
We didn't say it was media-conscious necessarily, that or media-mindful. But apropos media, because this is, after all, the Media Beat, and it's very easy to stay on one. It is actually pretty amazing how The media has a fairly media-centric topic, but there are some other things going on in the world. And what I wanted to ask you about is how, given the, it's almost as though there's a telephoto lens on one thing and one thing only. When things are presented. A couple of weeks ago, it was one thing, and this week, you know what I'm saying? It's just like there's almost as though it's a story of the week.
And there are times when one story will dominate the entire airwaves, the entire web, it seems, and every front page. And I think the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas School shooting is absolutely one of those cases. And it's entirely understandable. On the other hand, you know, as I've often said in this program, there is that much hallowed phrase, hallowed by me in a way, that the BBC, good old BBC, uses often, even at times like this, just that wonderful phrase from the news announcer that goes, "And now for other news." The other news tends to get wiped off the slate completely at times like this. It is unfortunate, yeah.
And that's...
What are you thinking of? What are you thinking of that's going missing now?
Oh, it doesn't matter. Syria, North Korea.
all those things. Yeah,
and
sure.
It's not that they're. It's not that they are international, and you know, one should. It's just that they were very much, and they were very much news stories, X weeks ago. You know, if you are keeping track. Then it's just, I find it pretty...
Well, Syria itself is in danger of becoming our next long war. Not that we're directly involved. Ah, no, but we are directly involved to some degree. And doubtless there's a severe possibility we'll get even more involved as time goes on. It's 6 years now. Who knows how long it's going to go on.
Especially when we kill 40 to 50 Russians.
There's a particularly spicy danger involved,
yeah, I mean,
of course, of direct confrontation
yeah.
with, of course, Putin's Russia. Always something of a rogue element in every event.
I'm not saying that we were that this is something horrible that we did, but that's one of the things when you have a conflict like this, when you have so many different sides,
you have
things
proxy
like
wars.
Things like this happen where. Where 50 Russians nationals who were there get killed in a strike that they weren't meant to be where they were. I mean, wars have erupted over smaller things than that.
And that's why.
Sure. And imagine the media reaction if it had happened the other way around.
Yeah.
Right.
And some American service people had been killed.
So
very different story for us.
But also whitewashing the story was the additional indictments yesterday about the Department of Justice really lining up, and it's so obvious what they're doing. You don't even have to be a lawyer to see that they're lining up life sentences for these two guys to try to get them to flip, and they're not going to flip because the president's going to pardon them. That's the whole thing about this.
Yeah, but again, the whole thing about that is if you have a few remaining brain cells that you can connect things, just like. The point is that the media. I'm sorry. The media doesn't connect dots for you, and I think that that's just unfortunate.
Well, some try, and I'm afraid at a time where the tunnel vision takes over at a time like this, then you're not likely to see. The other stories at the periphery get the attention they need, perhaps, and certainly that fundamental job of connecting the dots is the kind of job, we've said this again and again too, that takes time and effort, and you're not going to get it every day. But at times like this, you know, it's important not to forget. I hope that newsrooms will keep up the good, you know, there are many, actually some very salient newsrooms around the country that are doing fine work in terms of long-term investigative reporting that good, you know, takes up good shoe leather and lots of reporters' time. Let's hope that you know, even when there's crisis reporting going on and people have to, you know, the phrase in the trade is they need to flood the zone of the main story of the day, Let's hope that not too much in the way of resources are diverted to those matters of immediacy and away from the matters of long-term investment, which are providing some rewarding briefings for us every now and again. You get a very good takeout on what, for instance, Prosecutor Mueller is doing. In the terms of their trade, it's called, the phrase is drafting the landscape, preparing the outlines of a case, and starting with what you can say is the backdrop, like all those Russians being indicted a few days ago. That starts to set the landscape on which you can start, as Marshall was saying, to start to flip people with the build-up of evidence that might frighten them. But of course, you know, in the background, waiting always, as there was, for instance, with Scooter Libby in the Bush administration, found guilty in the end of lying to federal officers about an investigation. He in the end got his sentence commuted by the president. And similar possibilities are, of course, open to this president. He may be able to keep a lid on all of the information in the end, if there is more information likely to come out that will be politically embarrassing, and perhaps even the basis of an impeachable case against him.
The only option that really anybody has, and it is an open option because a lot of these crimes were committed in the state of New York. Presidential pardon does not cover state; it covers federal.
As many a lawyer I know can say quite often, where there's a will, there's a way.
That's exactly.
And there may be a will, a strong will in New York State. Absolutely.
Most certainly.
And then, you know, there's a small matter of, this is going to sound really naive, but, you know, there's a practical threshold where politics, you know, is really interesting to people who are interested in politics and not necessarily so interesting in people who are trying to get elected or stay elected. So there's a whole other thing going on which people actually should be focused on about how they can affect change and who they should be voting for based on their functional needs of existing, but it gets very distracting when you're sitting watching the sort of daily unfolding of a major situation, as with Scooter Libby, as with Iran-Contra. I remember, you know, watching those hearings. The other day I was thinking of, for example, the Clarence Thomas hearings. Now, these have all absorbed, you know, like a great amount of mental energy and political capital, and it's just very striking to see, you know, like it's got to be covered, but you've also got to connect, if you will, with actual people who are living actual lives and trying to deal with actual things that they need representatives for.
Sure. I've argued several times over that this kind of sudden tunnel vision can overtake the media in general in this country. When you get 24-hour coverage, wall to wall, is a function directly of the appearance and then preeminence of 24-hour news cable stations. In particular, well, CNN was the first, of course. But the fact is that all it does is amplify a natural tendency anyway. If you think way back to the Watergate hearings, that was an occasion too, and then we only had the three networks to, and of course the entire schedule wasn't given over to it, but they were a national focus for a time, and they were just about the only thing that people were reading, watching, listening about, and it certainly got the country's attention in a kind of single-minded way. Now it's not so single-minded because there's always something going on that you know will fracture the solidity of people's attention. But certainly, given the nature of what we have now, certainly in the shape of the various 24-hour cable news outlets now, MSNBC and Fox in particular, as well as CNN, excuse me. but given the fact that it comes at you in such a sort of fire hose way, it's very difficult to think about anything else except the main story on the agenda.
Yeah, and the other tricky thing is that often what's not covered, what's dribbled out later, is useful in informing an opinion, but its very absence means that it's left out of the dialogue for that moment, and then you've got to run back in. And it sort of reminds me a bit of cooking when you leave something critical out. And you try and throw it in at the end and hope that your cake rises, so to speak.
And, interesting analogy, yeah.
And it's not,
well,
it's,
sure. Thing, I mean, to change the analogy, it's a very difficult juggling game. Being a news editor these days, it's sometimes it's kind of obvious what your main topic is, but it sure is if you've got ever shrinking resources, as most newsrooms have these days, it's really hard to know what to do when you've got a story of gigantic proportions, as in the moment, how you keep the other long-term projects going without damage, without diminution of the attention that they need.
Yeah, and again, it's this is where it would just be. This is a dream of mine, but and I acknowledge up front that it's a dream. This would be a perfect place where if you could just have the information without it being colored to support your political leanings, that would just be great. Anyway, but I
wouldn't
I
it.
Say,
wouldn't it? Yeah. I recommend to you a running series now on BBC World Service. I don't know why I'm talking about the BBC so approvingly this week, but it's not just nostalgia. But I do think that the BBC manages to keep standards, the flag of standards, flying pretty high. The program I'm thinking of is just called My Favorite Country, and essentially it's an effort. Well-meaning effort. I mean, it's a little gets to be a little pious at times. It's a well-meaning effort to identify policies that different countries have that are particularly successful, and investigating them one at a time, and saying, if you were to start from scratch and assemble your own perfect country, what policies would you have? What would you borrow from different countries around the world? It's an interesting exercise, especially for people who are interested in policy making.
Yeah, when we in affiliation with Bard had some kids over here from Marshall. Where were they from? They were from all over, and it was a State Department sponsored program. When we had the Bard kids here and they were sitting in the studio,
they were from Saudi Arabia and Palestine, and so forth. And they had the most amazing stories about where they were from and about this country as
but
well.
But they sat in Marshall's studio and they basically said, "Well, don't you worry about the government, controlling, censoring what you say." And you know, this is a 19-year-old. You couldn't get into the program if your English wasn't excellent. Like, these were very high-achieving kids. And they'd just grown up with, their environment was one where governments were just flat out, had a different agenda than that of the people.
Oh, sure. There's an awful lot going on in other countries that we would not want to emulate.
Absolutely. But you never...
Isn't it interesting how the momentum, if you like, on the whole question of gun control is falling now? The prominent voices are those now of teenagers who have grown up in the fairly privileged. I mean, I don't think Stoneman Douglas School is a particular example of great privilege. It certainly isn't. Its contrast from here, 45 miles away, is quite considerable. But they have the one privilege of free speech, and they're exerting it to the maximum, it seems to me, at the moment. And the media, of course, is on the whole loving it. And of course, it is generating conspiracy theories from proponents of the Second Amendment, the more extreme proponents of the Second Amendment, of course, even accusing some of these young people of being crisis actors, people who are putting on an act, who travel from crisis to crisis, and of course they're not, and that's an accusation easily dealt with. But the air is poisoned around the now very articulate voices of young people under the age of 19 who are taking this issue to the White House and to the wider nation. This is an extraordinary thing for the media to be following, and I think they're handling it on the whole very well. Of course, there have been some cases of media exploitation of the young people too, which is not so good. But on the whole, this is something that wouldn't be happening in many other countries, I don't think.
Well, you know the interesting thing about...
But, of course, they wouldn't have the issue for it to be caused to happen in the first place.
The great thing about the students and what they're doing, not only at that school but other schools that are starting to get together, is that they're not making this about the Second Amendment. Their fight is not with the Second Amendment. Their fight is with the ability to stop assault-style guns. It's not the Second... You know, that's the interesting thing that these students are doing, which... politicians of the Democratic and Republican Party and the Independent and the Green Party have not done. The groundwork and the fight has always been over the Second Amendment. These students come from a state where they probably half those students have the right to shoot guns. And it's not about the Second Amendment. It's about assault-style weapons. And that's, I think, a breakthrough here that will get through to other young people throughout the country. It might take 6 months. It might take a year. It might take 2 years. But I think their struggle, not against the Second Amendment, but against assault weapons, will eventually be successful throughout the country. It will light a fire. I think whoever came up with their tactic of doing what they're doing is just an incredibly smart person, and they're carrying it out perfectly.
And that is one of the benefits.
Well, there are very smart students at that school, and it's of course perfectly clear that other people are helping them too. But the point is that in media terms, it's often argued that you're not best placed to cover an issue if you're on the ground. It's much better to provide the most salient political analysis if you are elevated from it and you can get a better overview. In this case, the particular crux of the issue that you've just described very well, Marshall, has come from the people absolutely on the ground. And it's not a matter, the argument for the moment can not necessarily be about the big principle of the Second Amendment, but absolutely about the availability of particular kinds of especially dangerous weapons. And that's a very good wedge issue for people to exploit, if you like. And if I were a student at a school, I would be wanting to focus on that as well.
But what is brilliant, and we're going to have to say goodbye, but what is really smart is if you reframe something, then you, in many cases, can make headway where you would not otherwise. And so...
Quite possibly. Well, we will see. We will see.
We will, and we will hope for the best on this one. Thank you very much, David Tereshchuk, The Media Beat.
Thank you.